Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Paris Alston, and this is a special hour of Radio Boston. Join us on a journey as we explore Massachusetts. We start by going off the mainland to learn about the natural history of Martha's Vineyard. And we dive into the island's African-American heritage.
That is what is unique about Oak Bluffs. That black people doing well is the default. You know, that is the norm. That is the bottom line, the baseline. We should be proud of that.
We visit a national park in Lowell that doubles as a museum.
Absent this park, who knows what would have become of the historic infrastructure that was where the Industrial Revolution took place.
And we take a walk along Cape Cod's outer beach.
Just when I think that the novelty of the beach has worn off, I've seen everything that there is to see, the beach will do something to disprove me.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Paris Alston. Welcome to a special edition of the show. It's Labor Day weekend, and whether you're already out soaking up those last precious days of summer or still making your plans, we want to invite you to join us as we explore the region. We'll take a walk along Cape Cod's outer beach, visit a unique national park in Lowell that's also a museum of the industrial age, and go to Oak Bluffs to experience the long history of African-American life there. So let's start by taking the ferry to Martha's Vineyard with former Radio Boston producer Allison Bruzek. Allison went there in 2017 to meet up with David Foster, ecologist and director of the Harvard Forest and author of A Meeting of Land and Sea, Nature and the Future of Martha's Vineyard. They spent an entire day exploring some of Foster's favorite spots on the island, and here's what they discovered.
Passengers, bicyclists, you're next.
Driving in his silver Prius, David Foster and I are taking a ferry to the island off the southeast coast of Martha's Vineyard, Chappaquiddick. He wants to show me, in a most dramatic fashion, the importance of looking at the history of a place to understand its future. We're headed to Waysquee Point, home to some of the fastest rates of erosion on the eastern seaboard.
Look at the fog, though. Marvelous. So we'd want to get within about 4 feet.
Just beyond the fog, we can see the barrier beach. It's a strip of sand that barely crests out of the water and runs parallel to the shore. The ridge protects the cliff we're standing on, for now.
We're standing on a 25 to 30 foot tall kind of wall of sand looking down at the beach. So the water used to wash right up against this and just undermine. This is just pure sand. And so every time a wave hit it, it just crumbled. So the beach now protects the bluff, but you can still see the evidence of the big trees that have fallen from the bluff. When the barrier beach breaks and when there's a big storm, this kind of beach disappears overnight. So it's completely ephemeral. Looks so permanent, so solid, but water washes it away in nothing.
The ocean takes 3 to 5 feet of the South Shore on average each year, and it was a hard lesson learned for the area's most notorious piece of architecture, the Shifter House.
So this house used to be right there on the very edge of the bluff. It's an immense house. It's something on the order of 8,000 square feet. So it was quite a feat to move that whole thing. So that house was built in a place that it should never have been allowed if people had paid good attention to the historical understanding out here. They would have realized how vulnerable it was. Hundreds of feet of coastline receded backwards and eroded. It's pure sand going down about 20 feet on that bluff. So it was very easy to erode.
Foster says the shifters, their planners and engineers, and everyone who approved the house took too short a view of history. Had they looked back centuries to work done by coastal topographer Henry Whiting, they would have seen records calling Waisqui one of the most quickly eroding spots on the northeastern coast. And that same history now points to more powerful hurricanes.
The people who built the houses here, the boards that allowed them to build the houses here, they were surprised by the erosion. People will be surprised by the next hurricane because we could easily have hurricanes that are much more powerful than anybody has ever experienced, because we know that the 20th century hurricanes that affected Martha's Vineyard were modest in comparison to the ones that occurred here in the 19th century and especially the 17th century. So we might be less surprised if we spent more time looking at history.
And ultimately, Foster says, based on history, we know what will happen to the shifter house.
The beach will move to the north, and all the property that this fellow owns will be lost.
It's sobering context for the future, and something Foster wants people to keep in mind. Back in his car, we drive to a place with a much happier conclusion, and one of his favorite places on the island.
You want me to give away my favorite spot?
Okay, I won't entirely reveal the location, but he describes our setting.
We're standing here right adjacent to the old Indian burial ground on Chappaquiddick, overlooking Cape Pogue Bay. We can see the lighthouse off in the distance.
It's a beautiful scene. The blues of the water set against the bright greens of lush island vegetation. But Foster likes it for more than its beauty. It's one of the island's great conservation stories. He points toward the pasture land and brush to our left.
Out in front of us is, in a sense, one of the future directions for conservation, which is conservation is not just protecting intact sites, it's managing sites so that they become even more beneficial for nature and for people.
It used to be dotted with houses. Now it's thriving flora.
The tendency in affluent places is to conserve nature or conserve old farmland and just try to hold it as it is and not use it at all and kind of freeze nature. Well, you can't freeze nature to begin with, but all that landscape actually used to produce food or timber or whatever. At the same time, we want to eat well and we want to live in wooden houses and have beautiful wooden desks and furniture and so on. So the wood and the products have to come from someplace. And so we can learn much more about conserving better and then utilizing nature to our advantage, but in ways that respect nature.
Our last stop on the tour is a woods preserve next to the main road that winds around the vineyard.
This is one of the big intact forest areas on the island.
Here, Foster wants to show me the ways in which nature can and will continue to cope without humans intervening.
There was this outbreak 3 years in a row of a native caterpillar that defoliated the oaks, and then in the third year there was a drought and all the trees died. I mean, literally across the entire ridge, all the trees died. And since then, the trees have gradually lost all their branches and lost all their bark and are starting to fall over. And at the same time, there's been this absolutely phenomenal resurgence of young growth, of new saplings, of sprouts, of new seedlings. And in the intervening time, all the plants that were in the understory, all of the blueberries and huckleberries and all the seeds that were in the soil, like raspberries, have all just flourished. And so there's been this incredible kind of banquet of berries in what was a forest. And so it's a perfect example of the way that nature copes with what we would perceive as a disaster or as just incredible damage to the landscape.
I asked Foster about what's going to happen as the effects of climate change continue, and he surprises me.
Climate change impacts so far are relatively subtle. They're shifts in the timing of vegetation, greening up of particular species, and their population changes through the year, the time that they arrive, the times that they breed, and things like that. And those are relatively subtle in comparison to these massive changes that have occurred by direct human activity of building houses and so on. And so it's going to be a long time before climate change has an impact that is commensurate with that.
He says the hands-off approach for humans is the best way to allow the vineyard to thrive in the future.
As climate change impacts happen, as we have hurricanes, as we have insects that are defoliating forests or altering other types of vegetation, nature is actually remarkably resilient, but it's only resilient if we keep it intact.
That was David Foster, ecologist and director of the Harvard Forest, speaking with former Radio Boston producer Allison Bruzek about the natural history of Martha's Vineyard. The island has a big cultural presence in this region. The ferry ride to it, the beaches and seafood, and of course the fact that it's a summer place for the rich. But I grew up in North Carolina, a long way from Martha's Vineyard. And before I came here, what I knew about the island is that it was a haven for African Americans. I'd seen Jaws, but the movies that really struck home for me were Charles Burnett's The Wedding and Mattie Rich's The Inkwell.
Are you trying to break my door down?
You call me?
I did?
Yeah.
Maybe I did. It doesn't matter now. You're here, right? So what do you want to do?
Do?
What do you want to do, Drew?
I don't know. What do we want to do?
Is that your bike?
Yeah, that's my bike. Yeah, that's my bike.
I want to ride your bike. I want to ride your bike downtown to the arcade.
To the arcade?
But I want to drive your bike.
You want to ride my bike?
Yes.
See, yeah, it has all the new features.
Come.
Oh, sorry. After you.
Thank you.
It has all the new features, the horn, the bell.
Drew, yeah. Just teach me how to ride, okay? Save the history.
Oh, okay. Well, it's quite simple. All you do is pedal, and I'll do the rest. I'll guide it. Okay, we're ready.
All right, come on.
Okay.
To you, that might seem like a simple moment between an awkward teenage boy and his crush. But for me, as an African American, it was amazing to see movies in which Black families were spending leisurely time at their summer vacation homes, riding bikes, hanging out at the beach, playing tennis, being carefree. And something magical always seemed to happen while they were there. Those movies were based off the town of Oak Bluffs, a place that holds special significance for African Americans. In the late 1800s, Martha's Vineyard attracted freed slaves and laborers. As they began to settle there, they faced racial discrimination and segregation. Oak Bluffs was one of the few places where African Americans were allowed to buy property on the vineyard up until the 1960s. As time went on, it emerged as an enclave for Black property owners. Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. talked about the town in A Place of Our Own, a documentary film by Stanley Nelson, which details the African American experience on Martha's Vineyard.
It's great to be able to associate with people who share your interests, the educational background, to put it bluntly, your class interests. That is what is unique about Oak Bluffs, that Black people doing well is the default. You know, that is the norm. That is the bottom line, the baseline. We should be proud of that.
Professor Gates is getting at an important piece of the vineyard's history, that it was a place where Black people could be themselves, own property, and relax while on vacation, and where that wasn't a surprise. So I decided to go on my own exploration of the vineyard, and especially Oak Bluffs, which is on the island's northern side. Today, it's a place where many Black people have homes that have been passed down through their families for generations. Harriet Smith is one of those people. She grew up in Chicago, but back in the 1940s, her grandmother bought a cottage right by the Inkwell. That's the beach where Blacks have always been known to hang out on the vineyard. Some say its nickname comes from the Black artists and writers who occupied the space. Others say it came from white vineyarders offensively describing what the beach looked like when it was crowded with black vacationers. Smith remembers coming to the vineyard as a little girl. Now she shares that tradition with her children and grandchildren.
Every year when school was out, we got in the car and drove 3 days to get to here and spent the entire summer because my grandmother was able to have this property. So that's a summer home for us. We've always had it. It's had it that long. And, of course, my children grew up here, you know, in the summers, and it just became a part of who we are.
The vineyard has a reputation of being a place for affluent Black Americans who can afford summer abodes that can cost anywhere from $2,500 to $20,000 a week to rent, let alone owning them. But as Gabrielle Abelard told me, the island is a place where African Americans don't have to explain themselves.
It's not something that we're used to, especially in Boston. You know, we're all professionals here, and it's something that you don't run into. Like, people are used to seeing successful Black people here.
I spoke with Elaine Weintraub, who co-founded the island's African-American Heritage Trail alongside Carrie Tankard in 1989. Weintraub says the trail tells a story of people who refused to accept the limitations white society imposed on them.
5 generations ago, when those properties were acquired, that was a tremendous achievement against a time in U.S. history when that was not an easy thing to do. For those people, those shoulders that the 5th generation are now standing on. These were heroes. These were people who achieved against all the odds, and I think that's the story. That's what makes the vineyard different.
To get a taste of what she's talking about, I went on one of the driving tours around Oak Bluffs, led by Joanne Joseph. Her favorite part of the tour is the home of Emma Maitland. Maitland was a woman born to poor sharecroppers in Virginia, where she fell out of a tree when she was 9 years old and was bedridden for a whole year following. She recovered and later became a teacher. Then, as Joanne explained to our group of 5 on the tour, Maitland took on a new venture.
This is her home right here with the beige paint and white trim. And once her husband passed away, she decided that she's going to take her baby girl to her mother in Virginia, and Emma Maitland moves to France and start dancing at the Moulin Rouge. Yeah, and I have visuals of Emma Maitland dancing at the Moulin Rouge.
Wow.
That's her.
Wow.
She gets the idea to do. I know. And can you believe how short they are? This is like late 20s, but you know it's France.
And it's Moulin Rouge.
So she started doing these little boxing skits, and that gives her the idea to take out a boxing license in France and in New York, and Emma Maitland becomes the world lightweight boxing champion.
What?
Yeah, yeah.
What?
Yeah.
What happened?
Page,
I mean, from a dancer to being a boxer.
Page 180. This is Emma Maitland in her boxing outfit. This is an actual bill. And her purse is $600 per fight. So
that's a lot of money back then.
Yes, things cost pennies back then. So she's doing really well. And so eventually she moved back to the States. She worked at a boxing gym for a few years. And then she decided she would go back to school and become a nurse.
Wow. She's like the first million-dollar baby.
Yeah.
Like that movie
she
with Morgan
smart.
Freeman.
You never heard of her. I mean, that's eclectic but smart at the same time.
She's
look at that.
True Renaissance woman. She just kept reinventing herself over and over again. I mean, just a great life, in my opinion. I know it starts with a lot of tragedy, but she never let that stop her. So.
She really turned lemons into lemonade.
She did. And add vodka to it.
Joanne is from Haiti and says leading tours has taught her a lot about the island's Black history. After the tour, she told me what it means for her to be a steward of the island's Black history. She started by talking about the Scherer Cottage, which was the first inn on the island that welcomed African Americans, as other hotels refused them.
The first time I went there, I had goosebumps because I did the tour a couple of times with Elaine, and I couldn't believe that this had been here the whole time I had lived here, and I knew nothing about it. So I decided that I'm going to study, and I'm gonna put on the best tour ever. I'm gonna, you know, just make it relaxed enough so that people are absorbing what has happened here, because so much has happened here. The way that I had of looking at the world was it was different because I'm from Haiti and we have a different culture. You know, I have real big shoulders to stand on and I have a lot of pride being a Haitian and coming here. So I'm like, I have my own history, so I'm good and secure. But doing the trail made me realize how important this is, how important to talk about the history of Martha's Vineyard and how important it is to talk about the history of Edgartown, for example. Because when I first came here, I was not comfortable in Edgartown. But I did not know that Edgartown was an abolitionist town, had Frederick Douglass speak here in 1857. That's important history that all Black people that come here should know, because our ancestors have been here and have lived here comfortably. And I feel like African Americans' history is not talked about enough. But I think it also needs to become just plain American history. When I first came here, I have some friends, and they're Caucasian and Portuguese, but they made sure they told me the history of the Inkwell. And they also told me how this was just African-American Mecca back in the 90s. So I knew about that, that they would have, like, amazing parties, and there were these big stars, basketball stars, movie stars that were here on Martha's Vineyard. So I knew about that aspect. I did not know that there were slaves in Chilmark. So that was a bit of a shocker, you know. So it's doing the tour has educated me about the history of Martha's Vineyard. The other part of doing the tour is that after you've taken people out, it's almost like they get this wind on their back and, you know, their chest puff out a little bit more. You know, I think a lot of people feel that way after they learn the history of the vineyard. It's just like a villain of pride and happiness. So it's like when you tell people about the cottagers, they're like, oh my God, the group of 100 African-American women who own property on the vineyard. I mean, there's great pride in that. The African-Americans are as accomplished as Caucasian-Americans are. And on Martha's Vineyard, we've done as much as they have. We've done as much to integrate into the community as they have. We've worked as hard to integrate into this community as they have. And we belong here. But at large, that's true for all of the United States of America. That we have been here. We've worked hard to be part of this country. And we have the right to be here. We're so integrated. We have a lot of biracial couples. And one of my jokes about the vineyard is that the half of the vineyard is related to the other half. So when you have that kind of dynamic, it's very hard for you to decide that, you know, there is a black and white relationship. And I suppose there is one, but it's not just this cookie cutter in a box, because it can't be. There are so many interracial couples. There are so many biracial children here. It just cannot be. You know, we all have to, we're just people trying to make it. I think that's the true essence of the vineyard, is that we all in this together. As Africans, we've contributed amazing thing to civilizations all over the world. And I think it's time to start talking about that, the accomplishments of Black people, that we are not lesser. We've accomplished as much as everybody else, and we have as much to contribute as everybody else. It's our world. It doesn't belong to anybody. It belongs to all of us.
Joanne reflected something that is ubiquitous on the island, especially among its Black inhabitants: joy, hope, and belonging. And as she says, knowing a place's history makes you feel like you belong there. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Paris Alston. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Paris Alston. All this hour, we're exploring places around Massachusetts that teach us something about where we've been and where we're headed. Earlier, we went down to Martha's Vineyard to explore the island's natural history and its African-American heritage. Now, we head up to Lowell, where in 2015, WBUR senior correspondent Deborah Becker visited the 141,000-acre Lowell National Historic Park. Joining her on that visit was now retired Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas and Peter Osella, who was then Assistant Superintendent of Lowell National Historic Park. Our visit took place amidst a national debate over funding to protect, maintain, and operate national parks. It's a conversation still reverberating today. We took a look at what that meant for the site in Lowell.
When you think of visiting a national park, you don't expect to hear something like this.
You can imagine the injuries, the hazards of working in a place like this.
Peter Osella is the assistant superintendent of Lowell National Historic Park. We met with him and Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas at the Boot Cotton Mills Museum. It's the centerpiece of the park, which features a replica of a turn-of-the-century mill weave room with 88 working power looms.
What you don't have here is cotton dust floating around. You know, OSHA doesn't have a sense of humor about that, so there's only so much authenticity in this process here. There are many, many industrial hazards. Occasionally, some of these shuttles moving back and forth at high speed would get dislodged and come out and hit someone. Women's hair could get caught in the belts.
It's a bittersweet history,
oh,
right?
Yes.
It developed
oh.
Lowell, certainly, yeah. But it was right. Not a pretty history.
When
all
visitors
the time.
Come to our visitor center, we're telling them the real story. And that's what national parks do. We don't sugarcoat it.
The 141,000-acre Lowell National Historic Park includes some 800,000 square feet of converted former mill space along the Merrimack River. It's one of 16 national parks in Massachusetts, and despite its $8 million a year budget, advocates say it and all 400 of the nation's parks need more money. It's something Congresswoman Tsongas is passionate about.
I remember my first trip to a national park. This is in 1960, and we were making the classic family road trip, and we stopped in Yellowstone and stayed in a little cabin. And I can remember waking up on a frosty morning and looking out and seeing a wolf sort of standing in the trees, and I've never forgotten it. And that's the kind of experience you want young people in particular to have, because there's nothing like how that stirs your soul.
Tsongas says the park also stirred economic development in downtown Lowell. When the Lowell Park was created in 1978, the mill industry was dying. And both Tsongas and Peter Osella say that the idea of an urban park was unusual at that time.
The focus of the Park Service had been natural areas, battlefields, monuments, and not industrial history. And in fact, the Carter administration testified against creation of this park and said, we don't do industrial history. Well, of course, now they've got dozens of industrial history-oriented national parks, but this was the first. I mean, I think people are eager to feel authentic experiences, and that's what we offer them.
And protect that history, not only to experience that history, but protect that history, because absent this park, who knows what would have become of the historic infrastructure that was where the Industrial Revolution took place. It's important that we protect it for all Americans so that we better understand who we are and why we are the nation we have become.
I think here, the creation of the National Park, it provided some hope and a theme that historic preservation is going to be our way, our method.
Can we walk a little bit and see the water?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great.
The water's why Lowell exists.
It's just beautiful.
This is the Riverwalk, which is part of the city of Lowell. The city owns it. However, we, the National Park, sort of integrate right into it. The fact is, the city got the funding it got for this walkway because the National Park Service is here. We actually applied for the funding. Then we turned the money over to the city to enable them to build this great resource.
One of the things that goes unnoticed is that park funding in general has dropped significantly in the last 10 years. So it's down about 22%, and it's led to a lot of deferred maintenance.
Is there any consideration to raising fees or doing anything like that to try to make up for some of the money so you would have more financial resources to do some of that deferred maintenance?
Well, I think that's always on the table, but it's a tough balancing act because you don't want to raise the fees to the point where you shut out a lot of people from being able to participate. So the reality is these are America's parks. These are America's lands, and it should be part of our routine appropriations process that we as a country are going to invest in the things that are precious to us. It's captive of the bigger debate about what is the role of the federal government. And these are our national treasures, and as such, we should be investing in them.
There's a move in Washington, it's my understanding, to decide maybe states take over some of this instead of the federal government. Would that be maybe something that might be beneficial because the states actually see directly what's going on when they can see the parks?
If we make a decision that something is of national significance, then I think it falls to the federal government to maintain and protect those sites. Federal lands have a multi-purpose role. They're not about mineral extraction or economic development. They have to be thought of in terms of preservation issues, how you protect wildlife habitat. A whole host of things have to be balanced. There may be instances in which there are some discrete pieces that might logically go back to a state, but as a whole, I think it's probably going down a pretty risky path.
I think if you were talking to the state officials, Department of Conservation and Recreation, they would tell you they are extremely stressed to manage what they have. So the idea of taking on more might be something that even they might be very concerned about.
So. And there's no guarantee that these lands, once they revert to the state, will be preserved and protected as they are under federal management. So what you do is you put at risk the history of this country.
So have you been meeting with your colleagues to talk about this?
How to
deal with
it?
So what's happening?
We have ongoing debates about just the nature of what kind of funding should take place in our national parks. But I share a committee with many members from states that do not similarly embrace the role of the federal government, whether it's through the Park Service or the management of other lands.
Attendance is down.
The Park Service is fighting everybody's connection to screens and high-tech stuff and trying to get people outdoors. And there is a big social media push. They're using the 100th anniversary to do a public service campaign.
Peter mentioned there are a lot of folks attached to their screens, and that may be a reason for declining visitors to parks. Why do you think that there's been a decline in the number of people coming?
Well, it's hard to tell, but I certainly think it's something that the National Park Service has to think about, really think about hard, because, as I said, those who come to them, I think, are moved by them, take away something they won't realize unless they visit. They have to visit to get it. We've got to think about new ways to reach people and attract them. So whether it's creating different experiences once you're there, that might be part of it, but I think it requires some innovation.
There was some recent articles and columns about our national parks being very white, very frequented primarily by white people. And is there any sort of effort to change that? And what do you do to change that?
There's a working group out there that is thinking about it. I think part of it is bringing more diversity to the Park Service itself. That is an issue, and it's something that the Park Service is starting to address but needs to be more aggressive with it. Like anything, if you see people that look familiar to you, you're more likely to participate and want to be a part of it.
Your thoughts about that, Peter?
Yeah, it's been a big part of the recruitment process for Park Service. When we get resumes, they don't indicate race or, you know, whatever. But there is this desire to make the Park Service ranks reflect the communities they're in all the more. Very often, say, the Hispanic community might not have had that childhood experience that you had. So you don't have people coming up who might have shared that same experience and would want to reconnect with that. And so how do you introduce that? So I know there are folks within the Park Service nationally dealing with that. I'm not up on exactly where that stands right now, but it is a very major goal of John Jarvis, the director of the Park Service.
That was Peter Osella, then Assistant Superintendent of Lowell National Historic Park, speaking to WBUR's Deborah Becker in 2015. They were joined on a visit to the park by now-retired Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas. Coming up, we take a walk along Cape Cod's outer beach.
I always compare it to falling in love with someone. you have this passion to know them. You want to find out every possible thing about them that you can. At the same time, you hope you never will, that sense of mystery will remain.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Paris Alston. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Paris Alston. All this hour, we've been exploring the region from Martha's Vineyard to Lowell's Historic National Park. We end today's show on Cape Cod's Outer Beach, which one man has been walking for decades. His name is Robert Finch, and he's the author of The Outer Beach, a 1,000-mile walk on Cape Cod's Atlantic shore. In 2017, WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty joined him there. They didn't walk 1,000 miles, but together they discovered why people fall in love with the ocean in the first place.
We walk into the wind. Finch has walked the Outer Beach for more than 50 years, and on this day, it's at high tide. The sky is blue-gray. The water is gray-green, and the surf is kicking up whitecaps, a restless herd of watery wild horses. A nor'easter is on the way.
What about the beach makes it special to you?
Well, that's what all my writing for the last half century has been about. I always compare it to falling in love with someone. You have this passion to know them. You want to find out every possible thing about them that you can. At the same time, you hope you never will, that sense of mystery will remain. And I think that's been the case with me. I was just fascinated by it, I suppose, in a sensory manner. It's human scale. The whole Cape, to me, has a scale that reminds me of my own humanity. Mm-hmm. On the beach, it's the element of change. Change happens here on a scale that is close to what happens to change in my own life, and I associated with it that way. And that's really what's kept me here, I think. This sense that there's something non-human out there that I find parallels with in my own life, and I try to articulate that.
Can we walk a little bit more?
Sure, of course. The metaphor that most writers use to talk about what's happening out here is war or struggle between land and sea. That's a very human-imposed metaphor. And I don't think it really... And I've used it myself. It's just an easy one to come up to. Particularly after a very destructive storm, you just want to compare that landscape to a war site where everything looks freshly destroyed. But it's not. If you're going to continue to use human metaphors, it's more of a dance between the ocean and the land. And I think I say somewhere in one of the books that the ocean must, in a way, love the land that it takes, because it's given to it so freely, so easily. So I'm going to have to come up with a better word than reclaim, because the ocean never owned it, but it's taking it now.
But you know, it makes sense to me why writers and people just intuitively use, as you said, those very human metaphors.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, for the blink of an eye, in terms of the arc of time that this area has existed in, yeah, we're just occupying
the
tiniest blink of an eye. But to us, it does seem like there's a constant battle, even though, I mean, we're the interlopers.
Right. Yeah.
Because we're bad. I mean, like, right now, so many of the daily stories coming out of the Cape is people literally battling to save their homes.
Well, that's one of the things that's always fascinated me about the beach. I think what the core of my interest comes from, not just from the natural landscape itself, but how people interact with it and how they respond to what it does. And again, probably one of the more dramatic examples of that is how people respond to erosion. Now, if you're just like us today, a visitor to the beach, this is all very fascinating and beautiful and dramatic to watch this. But if you own a beach cottage or a house on one of these bluffs, and you know that the ocean is going to take your land surely with its power of eminent domain, it fascinates me how people respond to that. A lot of people, most people I would say, who have cottages on the beach or modest houses, accept it. They recognize that their time here on the beach is limited. But there is still this attitude among some people that we ought to be able to beat the ocean. We ought to be able to, you know, be a permanent fixture here and not have to give in to the inevitable. But they're wrong.
You talk about the many lessons you've learned walking these beaches. I mean, has the beach, has the Cape been a teacher to you?
Well, I have one essay in the book where I walk the beach with a friend who's come down from the hills of Vermont, and his life is undergoing some problematic changes, and he's looking for reassurance. And I realize that by living here on the beach, if there's a lesson, the lesson has been how to live with change. Change is inevitable. You have to accept it. You have to adapt to it and rethink your whole position. If you live in a place for a long enough time, it begins to shape your attitudes. It gives you, as I say, those images, those metaphors, those tropes that you can find useful in your own life.
So how have you changed? How has it shaped you?
Oh, my. I suppose as I get older, what the beach says to me more now than it said before is a lesson in mortality. You have to just sort of accept that that's part of the nature. Change is part of the nature of life, and death is part of the nature of life. I don't want to sound too somber about that. I guess that's one of the paradoxes I find on the beach, too. The beach is inhabited by organisms that are generally extremely fragile. A good example of that being these shorebird nesting areas, especially the tiny piping plovers, which nest right out here on the beach, and very often a storm in the middle of their nesting season will just wipe out the entire colony, and they go right back to nesting again.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're at once fragile and very enduring. And that seems to be innate in the nature of the beast, of the beach, that it harbors conflicting elements. It's constantly creating beauty and it's constantly destroying it at the same time.
Do you love the beach? Do you love the Cape in the same way that you did when you first came here?
Oh, of course it's changed. Again, the metaphor that always comes to fore is marriage. You know, marriage initially is an experience of possession and discovery. And after a time, it becomes something, well, I was going to say less dramatic, but more deeply satisfying. But I have to be careful about that, because just when I think that the novelty of the beach has worn off, I've seen everything that there is to see, the beach will do something to disprove me of the beach. No, I think I can't imagine living anywhere else, let's put it that way. I've grown, I don't want to use the word comfortable, but I've reached a rapport with the beach that I'm pleased, it pleases me.
To be in conversation with sand and surf for 50 years, honestly, I'm jealous of the soulful rapport Robert Finch has had with the outer beach. Can the young and distracted slow themselves, steady their gaze, and listen deeply enough to fall in love the way Finch did all those years ago? Maybe, the ocean seems to shrug. So I ask Robert Finch to inspire us a bit more. He reads the essay from his book about his first contact with the Cape a half century ago.
The first time I ever saw the outer beach was in the spring of 1962, April, I think, when I was 19. My freshman roommate at Harvard was John Hagenbuckle, whose father ran one of the dozen or so sailing camps that dotted the inner shores of Pleasant Bay in those days. It was not the first time I had seen the ocean. Growing up in urban New Jersey, I went with my family on one or two excursions to Asbury Park. And I have a memory, when I was about five, of standing in the waves, which were as tall as I was then, and of being lifted by them, gently and with a sense of benignity. But we were mostly lake people in the summers, and after our family moved to West Virginia when I was 12, I did not see the ocean again until that spring on Cape Cod, 7 years later. John and I left Cambridge sometime after 11 at night, driving in his old VW Bug. There was a full moon and no other traffic on Route 3 for most of the way down. Somewhere around Plymouth, having seen no other cars for a while, John turned off the headlights, and we drove for several miles by the light of the moon. It was like entering another world. We stayed that night in one of the camp cottages in South Orleans. The next day, a late spring northeaster strafed the land, whipping up a wild surf that assaulted the beach. We drove out to Nauset Beach, buttoned up in the foul weather gear that John had provided, and shouldered our way against the wind and rain out of the parking lot and through a gap in the dunes. When I first beheld that wild beach, it overwhelmed whatever anticipations or expectations I might have had. My reaction totally surprised me and was, at the time, inexplicable. I turned full front to the ocean, raised both my arms, and began to conduct. I waved my arms out and in, up and down, in rough time to the surf's irregular rhythm. Of course, I was conducting nothing. Even then, I felt that the ocean was something that took absolutely no cognizance of me. If anything, it was I who was being conducted by the sea, trying to catch its rhythms and tempi, trying awkwardly to become a part of its overwhelming majesty. Now, at a distance of more than five decades, my reaction seems understandable, even predictable. The only thing in my life thus far that was at all commensurate to what I was experiencing on that beach was symphonic music, mostly the Romantics, Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff, Dvorak, and Sibelius, especially Sibelius. I had spent much of my adolescent years in West Virginia in our family's darkened pine-paneled basement rec room, listening to 33 and a third LPs of those composers on my Motorola portable stereo with detachable speakers. It was my drug of choice in those pre-drug days, my substitute for sex in those pre-sex days. I would often stand in front of the turntable conducting the music in the dark as a way of becoming part of it. It called forth a depth of emotional and psychic response unlike any I had ever experienced or would until that day on the beach. Like the music, but of vastly larger proportions, the storm waves gave me the sense of illimitable power and irresistible force, of lavish, inexhaustible beauty, a mixture of desire and fear, all held within laws, patterns, and a sense of order too vast and complex for my adolescent mind to recognize, let alone understand, but which I nevertheless felt deeply. I stood on the brink of something that could, if I overstepped my bounds, swallow me up instantly, annihilate me utterly, but which, if I showed the proper respect, caution, and patience, might tolerate me, not shut me out, and perhaps eventually might even allow me an audience with his august presence. My awkward attempts at conducting, I can now see, were unconscious and instinctive, an homage, a recognition of a power I had never encountered before, and a desire to somehow be a part of it.
That's author Robert Finch reading from his essay, First Contact, which is part of his book, The Outer Beach, A Thousand-Mile Walk on Cape Cod's Atlantic Shore. With that, I hope you'll have the chance to do some exploring of your own this Labor Day weekend. If you check out any cool places or books or movies, tell us about it on our website, radioboston.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Walter Withman, and me, Paris Alston. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Tiziana Deering is our host. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. Have a fabulous weekend and join us Monday for more Radio Boston.